All right, good evening. Welcome, everyone. Is there anyone who's new today, tonight? All right, welcome, welcome, welcome. All right, my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. So we'll start with our meditation for about 40 minutes, offer just a little bit of guidance, then I'm going to offer a talk around happiness as we explore the transcendental origination. All right, so let's just settle into our practice. A poem by Tom Hennen called Love for Other Things. It's easy to love a deer, but try to care about bugs and scrawny trees. Love the puddle of lukewarm water from last night's rain. Leave the mountains alone for now. Also the clear lake surrounding by pines. People are lined up to admire them. Get close to the things that slide away in the dark. Be grateful even for the boredom that sometimes seems to involve the whole world. Think of the frost that will crack our bones eventually. Love for Other Things by Tom Hennen. All right, so welcome, nice to see everyone. So tonight, continuing this exploration of happiness. This is in the context of transcendental origination, so one of the ways the Buddha described this process of liberation in our hearts and minds. We're going to expand happiness a little bit broader tonight, some other contexts with it. Now, kind of a bigger context is just the history of Buddhism. As it goes through different countries, it actually gets transformed by those cultures. Those cultures start to change it, adapt it. Like, for example, when it went to China and Japan and Korea, it had this quality of Taoism starting to come into it. There's a quality of changing, morphing into a different expression of Buddhism. And those cultures themselves were also transformed by Buddhism itself. And now we are here in the West with this kind of new transformation happening as Western culture is being exposed to Buddhism and is changing based on that. And also the way it's expressing right now in the West is a new expression. So we're in the middle of it. And so sometimes as we do that, there's different words like happiness, which I think often need a little bit of extra unpacking because happiness is such a, we have a lot of thoughts around it, right? A lot of history, a lot of meaning around that word, happiness. And unpacking it with some consciousness can help us see how does this happiness from the Dharma's perspective translate into our own understanding of it. And this is also interesting, right? With this 4th of July is our 250th anniversary of our country. And the Declaration of Independence talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So it's built into how the country was founded. And we spend so much of our time trying to find that happiness. Where is that happiness lying? Is it in our families, our relationships, our possessions, our experiences, our sense of identity, our role? And yet for many of us, unhappiness is almost a epidemic, how much we feel that unhappiness and that sense of lack. And perhaps since what brought us to Dharma practice in the first place was a sense of something not quite working, or maybe some deep sorrow, some deep grief, some deep pain, and trying to find, listening to the words of the Buddha as a way to find our way through that. And of course, we have so many messages about what will make us happy. You know, you look at any advertisement, any social media, people are always telling you, if you buy my thing, you'll be happy. This will fix your problem. This will make you a better person. It'll make you a happier person. This possession, this relationship, this experience, this identity, these are these messages that we're just swimming in. It's really what makes our whole one of the things that makes our capitalist economy churn and continue to move. So our culture has a lot of baggage around this word, happiness. And then we start to practice, we start to hear the Dharma, we start to practice the Dharma, we learn how to meditate, we hear the teachings, these ancient teachings, and we start to get a sense of this very happiness that we're pursuing, maybe the way that we're holding it, the way we're understanding it, is part of the problem. And maybe we need to reframe that, get a different way of understanding it. And perhaps we hear from a Buddhist or a Dharmic perspective that true happiness is outside the conditions of our life, outside of the circumstances and the details of our life, that happiness is free of those. And so it's a happiness that is able to go through change, loss, and grief, and still have this quality of ease in the midst of. And yet we have this issue that our whole culture and how we've been raised points toward pursuing happiness in a different way. You know, through these external experiences, external possessions, this internal transformation. As we're trying to reconcile these different messages around happiness from the Buddhist perspective and also from our culture can be a little difficult. And one thing that sometimes happens is that we start to have this spiritual idealism. And we start to hear the Dharma and say, okay, I want to be a good Dharma practitioner. I want to not have my happiness depend upon the circumstances of my life. I want to feel that freedom, right? And that has a subtle way of turning into turning away or pushing away our other kinds of happiness, maybe even feeling a sense of guilt, like I shouldn't be happy with this circumstance because it's impermanent, it's going to change. That sense of denial that can seep in. And we sometimes wonder, my life is falling apart. Why aren't I happy? I've been meditating for 5 years now. Why am I still unhappy as things fall apart around me? And perhaps there's also that message that it's not okay to be happy, not to enjoy those pleasures of life. So it's trying to find how do we navigate this realm of happiness. So to do this, I want to bring forth a couple suttas that unpack this. The first one is really geared toward householders and how that kind of the happiness that we can feel as householders. The other one is more focused on the Four Noble, Four Noble Truths around dukkha in particular and some of the qualities that come up around it. Because happiness, it's one of those things that I think we all long for, and we start to understand a deeper level of happiness as our practice deepens and unfolds. So let's talk about that first sutta. This comes from the connected discourses, the numerical discourses. This is a long collection that's like the ones and the twos and the threes and the fours. And this is really addressed toward a householder. Householder went up to talk to the Buddha, went to seek some teaching, and the Buddha is addressing that. I think it's helpful to look at suttas not in terms of an absolute, but how the Buddha decided to answer the question to address this person based on what he perceived this person needed, right? So he maybe would have a little different answer for a different person, a different perspective. I have a sense that this particular person was perhaps fairly well off. Perhaps he had some wealth. And there's really four elements of happiness that the Buddha spoke of. There's the happiness of having, the happiness of using, the making use of our wealth, happiness of the bliss of debtlessness, and the bliss of blamelessness. Right? So let's unpack those a little bit first off. So the Buddha is talking to this householder and saying, what is the bliss of having? There's a case where a person of a good family has wealth earned through their efforts and enterprise, amassed through the strength of their arm and piled up through the sweat of the brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. And they think, I have wealth earned through my efforts and enterprise, amassed through the strength of my arm, and piled up through the sweat of my brow. Righteous wealth, righteously gained. They experience bliss. They experience joy. This is the bliss of having, right? I like to bring this forth because sometimes we think it's the happiness that we hear or think about from a dharmic perspective is in this otherworldly quality. And that's certainly true. There's qualities of happiness that comes from meditative states. There's happiness that comes from insight, from seeing the nature of things, how they actually are. And that is a profound level of happiness. And there's also this happiness of just having enough wealth, enough ease in our life. And this is where our culture kind of collides a little bit with it. I remember a long time ago looking at something about some kind of financial training or ways to kind of improve your finances. And they said that they interviewed these different people. I think the number was around 10% thought, this is the number they thought, 10%, whether it's people who had very little, you know, on the poverty line, to people who are middle class or people who are quite wealthy. And everyone thought they just needed about 10% more to finally be happy. Right? So isn't that interesting? 10%, you know, if you're just struggling, 10% will let me pay my rent. 10%, you're in middle class, maybe I can get that car or whatever it is. You're very wealthy, 10% more. And we often have that sense in our lives that happiness is just a little bit outside our reach. You just need a little bit more. And we spend our whole lives going for that little bit more. So this is this paradox that we have to learn to have contentment, to have a sense of renunciation, of letting go. This is enough. This is enough for me to be comfortable, to be happy. And at the same time, the Buddha is saying it's okay to realize you will be happy with that good fortune. You will be happy with that, those means, with that wealth. So this is the bliss of having. The next one is the bliss of making use of wealth. Okay, so it's a similar phrase of there's the person using their, you know, basically amassing their wealth through their efforts. And then they use their efforts, I partake of their wealth and make merit. They experience bliss and joy through using that, to being with it, to expressing it. So again, this is it's okay to enjoy that, and enjoy that capacity to be able to use your wealth, to enjoy it, and to have a sense of taking care of your own needs and those around you, to have pleasure with it. And this again, but this our culture has this kind of illusion that okay, you need to get more in order to be finally happy, or that purchase, that experience, that's going to what finally make you happy. Once you get through work and you can retire, then you can be happy. Once you get to Friday night, then you can be happy. You know, there's always that little push, that little bit of leaning into it. So as practitioners, as Dharma practitioners, we start to have a little bit of a different perspective around this. But again, I want to bring forth that it's okay to use our money. It's okay to bring forth that. The next one is the debt, or the bliss of debtlessness, to be free of debt. So this is the case where the person of a good family owes no debt, great or small, to anyone at all. When they think, I owe no debt, great or small, to anyone at all, they experience bliss, happiness, and joy. This is called the bliss of debtlessness. Now this one, I think is, I remember my wife and I, actually before, I think we hadn't been married yet, but we had started to amass a little bit of consumer debt, and it was getting a little concerning. And I remember we're camping, doing backpacking up at LA Creek and Goat Lake in the wilderness. And we just were thinking about really having a commitment to stop being in debt, to stop adding more to our debt. And we did. We made that strong commitment. And it was hard. It was hard to bring the budget in, to balance it each month or twice a month, to really learn to live within our means. And gradually over time, that debt shrunk to nothing. And there was a freedom, there's an ease that comes from that. So the reason I like to bring up this sutta is that sometimes we feel this sense of difficulty in our lives, and we look at the Dharma to solve it, to fix it. If I just changed my mind, if I just changed my attitude, if I meditated in a better way, then that would solve all my problems. And sometimes our problem in our life is much more practical, right? It's a practical solution. How do we get out of debt? How do we learn to manage that? Remember the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that if we're not feeding our bellies, if we're not clothed, if we have food insufficiency, if we have, you know, a lot of difficulty, it's hard to go into something more spiritual. Those take priority. You know, so the Dharma can certainly help us meet anything with more ease, with more clarity, with more wisdom and compassion. And sometimes that's really what's needed. But not to neglect our own, you know, our well-being, taking care of ourselves. And this is one of the things that it's so helpful to do around debt. The next one is the bliss of blamelessness. Okay, so this one, so we talked about having money, using that money, having this freedom of debt, and how they're always a form of happiness. Now this starts to transform us from kind of the normal householder mode into one who's a Dharma practitioner. This is the bliss of blamelessness. So there's a case where a discipline of the noble ones is endowed with blamelessness, bodily karma, blameless verbal karma, blameless mental karma. So karma is actions, or how we're actually acting in our lives. When they think, I am endowed with blamelessness, they experience bliss, they experience joy. This is called the bliss of blamelessness. Now this one, I think, is so important, and especially in our culture, because we have many examples. You can look at some of the highest reaches of our government, for example, and notice that there's a lot of wealth being amassed. There's a lot of maybe pleasure in expressing that, but there's not this bliss of blamelessness. And this bliss of blamelessness is really following the precepts, not only the letter of them, but really the spirit of them, taking it as a deep practice that transforms the very way we are in the world. You know, how are we around the ethics when no one else is watching us, when no one is aware of us? You know, when no one notices that $20 bill that you just see, do you pick it up and pocket it, or do you find who the owner might be? Those are those moments that really define how integrated is our ethics into our life. Also, when life pushes against us, when there's difficulty, do we go back into our normal greed and hatred and delusion? Or do we have the ethics, our precepts, as this guiding force that keeps us not only benefiting ourselves, but everyone around us in profound ways? At the end of this sutta, sometimes there's little verses, and this one has a nice ending point. So knowing the bliss of deathlessness and recollecting the bliss of having, enjoying the bliss of wealth, the mortal then sees clearly with discernment, seeing clearly the wise one, they know both sides, that these are not worth 1/16th of the bliss of blamelessness. So the happiness of all these other ones, they're significant, they're real. And yet the bliss of blamelessness is worth so much more. All these other ones are not worth 1/16th. Okay, the Buddha said that following the precepts has immeasurable benefit for ourselves and for everyone else. It's a countless way to, it's impossible to measure that. Right? Think about when you act in a kind way, in a considerate way, in a non-harmful way, that action touches someone, and they touch someone else from that same quality, that same energy. Oh, that sutta is called Debtlessness, by the way. It's from the Numerical Discourses, number 462. All right, now let's turn to this other sutta. Now this one is actually focusing more on dukkha, on suffering. And so the absence of dukkha, we could say one aspect of that is happiness, is the joy, is the way I'm framing it tonight. Now this one, this is actually a two-part one. One is a section from the Buddha from the Samyutta Nikaya, the group discourses, 56.11. And this is the Buddha just describing the Four Noble Truths. Now, actually what dukkha is. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. Right? So I'm going to just look at those last few around this topic of happiness and see how that maybe informs it. Sometimes if you look at the discourses, things are defined more in the negative. You know, like nibbana is not so much defined as enlightenment. It's more of this turning off, this quenching out, this blowing out these flames. Because defining what it's by it's what it's not allows us, our mind, not something to grab onto. If we define it more in the positive, our minds might start to kind of latch onto it in a way that's not so helpful. Now this little description of dukkha, Sariputta did an elaboration on it in the Majjhimakaya 141, so the middle length discourses. So Sariputta was one of the chief disciples of the Buddha and would often have his voice shown up in the suttas. So he goes through and actually defines all these. He goes through piece by piece, you know, what is the dukkha, what is aging, what is death, what is sorrow? Each one of those. So let's look at those last ones and around it relates to happiness. So, and what is the stress or the dukkha? This translator often translates as dukkha as stress. What is the dukkha of associating with unbeloved? There's a case when undesirable, unpleasing, unattractive sights, sounds, aromas, flavors, or tactile sensations occur to me, or one has connection, contact, relationship, interaction with those who wish one ill, who wish for one's harm, who wish for one's discomfort, who wish no one security from the yoke. This is called the dukkha of association with the unbeloved. Now, this one's interesting because if you're not like me at all, when I started to practice, I started to think, I should get over all this. I should be okay with being with things which are unpleasant. I should be able to just, you know, be happy when things are painful around me. And this is the tricky part, the thread we do as practitioners. Because, yes, our capacity to hold the difficult, our capacity to find ease in the midst of the difficult, absolutely grows. And that's part of this freedom that starts to come forth, this freedom of the conditions of life. And it doesn't change that it's unpleasant. It just doesn't change that we might be a little happier if these things weren't here. Right? And that's what I'm trying to get at, that knot we sometimes get into as practitioners, is I want to be a good practitioner, but then I deny this natural preference of not wanting these unpleasant qualities. Sometimes I work with this just by acknowledging the Vedana. You know, Vedana, remember, is the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So when I'm feeling something unpleasant and difficult, instead of struggling with it and thinking I should be over it, I shouldn't be having this reaction, I shouldn't be feeling this, sometimes just stepping back and acknowledging this is an unpleasant experience, unpleasant feeling, unpleasant person I'm with, right? That sense of acknowledgement lets me step back a little bit. So I actually say, okay, this is the nature of this moment. And then the next moment is, how do I work with it? How do I meet it as best I can? How do I bring compassion for myself or for this other person, for this situation? And so happiness, there is a relative amount that is due to our circumstances. You know, for something unpleasant, something painful, happiness will be not quite as easily arising. We may have to work to allow that to arise. If things are pleasant, we feel that happiness much more easily. The next one is, what is the stress or the dukkha of separation with the loved? There's a case where desirable, pleasing, attractive sights, sounds, aromas, flavors, or tactile sensations do not occur to one, or to one has no connection, no contact, no relationship, no interaction with those who wish one well, who wish for one's benefit, who wish for one's comfort, who wish one security from the yoke, nor with one's mother, father, brother, sister, friends, siblings, companions, or relatives. This is called the stress of separation from the loved. So again, this is one of those distortions we get in. We think, I shouldn't be feeling this grief, this loss. I shouldn't be feeling this heartache of this breakup of this relationship. Remember the sutta where the Buddha is describing the loss of his two disciples. I think Sariputta was one of them. His kind of his dearest disciples, his dearest friends, and they had passed away. And he said, I look out in the room with, 500 monks and nuns here, and I feel like it's a vacant place. I feel like the light has gone out of the world. There's this expression of grief, of loss. And sometimes we use the Dharma to kind of deny our humanness, to deny this naturalness of that we like to be with people that we enjoy. We like to be with our loved ones. We like to be with who we are close to. And we reconcile that with the fact of impermanence, that every relationship that we have will end in disillusionment. It will fall away. We'll die or they will die. So how do we work with these and still find a quality of happiness? And it's okay to enjoy that happiness, to delight in it. Like that's the kind of the key thing I look at in myself, and if I'm working with a student, is how conditional is their happiness? Does the happiness is able to stay even when that changes? Can they enjoy this moment, enjoy this relationship, this connection, this pleasure? But when that pleasure ends, as it will, do they long for it? Do I feel that sense of attachment, that wanting to get back to it? Or am I able to release it gracefully and move into the next thing, meaning this next moment? It's the separation of what is pleasant, beloved. The next one is, what is the stress of not getting what is wanted? If being subject to birth, the wish arises, oh, may we not be subject to birth. May we birth not come to us. But this is not achieved by wanting. This is the dukkha of not getting what is wanted. In being subject to aging, illness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, despair, the wish arises, may we not be subject to those things. But this is not achieved by wanting. This is stress of not getting what is wanted. Of not getting what is wanted, right? Anyone ever not get what they want? there's this, it can be really painful when we really want something, we really hope for something, where there's this deep sense of longing. This is an aside of an example of this I saw. My wife and I sometimes like to watch Alone. Have you guys seen that series? When these people go out in the wilderness and they try to survive all by themselves, and at the end, the last person wins $500,000. And this one guy, he's been out in the Arctic for like 77 days. And he's thinking, okay, tomorrow they're going to come and they're going to bring my family. I'm going to win. But they don't come. And he's so disappointed. He's so devastated by that. That wanting of things. And this is very human. That's where compassion, I think, needs to be an equal companion to our mindfulness. Because mindfulness, we are able to see so much clearer. We can see the nuances of our experience, those subtle beliefs, all the sensations of our body, emotions. But without compassion, it can be a little bit aloof, a little bit kind of cool. And when there's suffering in this, you're not getting what we want. I'm not getting what I want in this moment. Can we feel compassion for that? And then paradoxically, when we do feel, we do get what we want, to feel the joy of that, to feel, allow ourselves to feel that happiness of that experience. But also holding it lightly, realize that these vicissitudes of worldly winds will blow. Gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. These flow back and forth between us. Right? So enjoying the successes, but noticing how we start to get attached around them. And the final one is around the five aggregates, five clinging aggregates. Now, I'm not going to go into the aggregates because we could spend a whole talk or a whole month or a whole year on those. But in short, this is kind of the critical kind of linchpin of all of it. Because when we feel, when those different effects of dukkha arise in ourselves, when that being with something that's unpleasant, the loss of something, not being with something that we loved, not getting what we want, what makes those painful, what makes those hurt, is that sense of self that forms around that sense of identification, the sense of me. Okay, so there's the kind of the different layers of self, of identification. There's a sense of me and my gender identity and my role as a teacher or as a father or as a husband. All those different roles are part of who I am. But deep, deep down behind that is this perspective of I, this sense of me, a sense of separation, that I'm separate from another person. I'm separate from you. You know, there's that sense of distance, that sense of identity, that sense of self. Now that's where the Buddha talks about the five aggregates. One of his, a really a beautiful way of describing the way we take things like form and perception, feeling tone, consciousness, bring those into that sense of me, that sense of self. When that sense of self is activated, we will feel suffering. We will feel dukkha. If it's a pleasant experience and it's wonderful, we're going to feel it when that ends. If it's an unpleasant experience, unpleasant moment, that's going to be the pain is right then and there. And so when we start to practice, it's kind of almost behind, it's almost in this, it's kind of under the cover. It's like a secret way that meditation starts to practice with us. When we say, learn, teach you how to meditate, we say, okay, sit down, relax the body, relax the mind. Try to open to what is here right now without judging it, without trying to fix it, just simply knowing it, allowing it to be felt, experienced. We practice with the breath, with sound, body sensations. But the very words are inclining us to, we could say, relax the sense of self, relax the sense of perspective, allow things to be just how they are. Because when we have that sense of wanting things to be different, when we're judging something, fighting against something, the sense of self gets really activated. And so we start to come almost in a behind-the-scenes kind of way, start to become more relaxed with the fact that sense of self is actually not always here. Right? And it's not like we are making something up that isn't already here. It just we forget that it's there. We forget that sense of self. It's just something that's arising based on conditions and falling away. Right? So this is kind of the key one of all of these, is these five clinging aggregates that creates this sense of suffering, this sense of self. So paradoxically, that's where the happiness that this main transcendental dependent origination is pointing toward is that sense of self, when that falls away, that's when happiness starts to really arise. That really is truly outside of conditions. The conditions do matter. They do affect us. They do have influence over our happiness. But there's a deeper quality of happiness which is outside of those conditions when that sense of self falls away. So in conclusion, just to acknowledge that some of our happiness is based in the conditions of our life. It's easier to feel happy when we're with people we love, when we're with pleasant sensations and experience. It's easier to be happy when we have enough money in the bank to pay our bills. We have enough wealth to enjoy it, to live life in a relaxed way. We have more ease when we have no debt or very little debt. We have more happiness when we live a life of blamelessness, when we're following the precepts, when we're, our actions are really imbued with this kindness, this non-harm. And to not get lost in this spiritual idealism, to deny those qualities of happiness. Those are beautiful parts of being human. And by doing that, we start to then discover, relax enough to actually see this deeper level of happiness that's truly outside of conditions. And that sense of self is no longer believed in and seen as our true identity, but we actually realize our true identity is much vaster than that. And there's an ease that starts to arise from that. There's a happiness that's beyond words, beyond circumstances and conditions. All right, can we just sit for a moment or two and let those words settle where they will? All right, thank you for your kind attention. And we have a chance now for any questions or sharing you might have.
Hi, I'm curious if there are any thoughts that you like to tell yourself to help you feel more happy or joyful.
Yes, are there any thoughts I like to tell myself to help kind of shift that? You know, it's for myself personally, you know, a lot of it has to do with this relationship to suffering, dukkha, personal constriction, and how do I kind of work, change my perspective around it. And so sometimes it's like loosening, the pathway to happiness is more about loosening the grip on the suffering than necessarily inclining myself toward happiness. That's just how I tend to be inclined. I think there's many examples or ways to bring happiness forth more directly. So it's kind of, you know, learning what's the right way to meet this in this moment. So sometimes I use a combination of, I tend to be pretty, I like to use investigation quite a bit. So, okay, what's actually here? And often the first piece is what actually is present, acknowledging this moment's experience. Sometimes the simplest gateway into that is feeling the body's experience of it. Because the mind's going to be trickly. It's going to be kind of squirrely and a little trickster. It's going to have all these stories. But the body has a simplicity of it. Okay, where exactly is this sorrow or this grief being felt as a body experience that grounds me into the present moment, grounds me to what's here? And then from there, I start to ask, okay, what is the what's the mental quality of it? What's the belief? What am I believing is true in this moment? And when sometimes I can feel that and sense that, and in that seeing of that, what I'm believing is true, I see that actually it isn't so true. It's not absolutely true. It's maybe just relatively true. And then that starts to shift me out of that contraction around that pain. So that's one way I personally tend to work with it a lot. I also like to broaden my perspective. If you ever, you know, it's Charlie Brown. I think one of the characters there would walk around and, you know, head down in a big funk and so on. Ask them about it. It says it's really hard to not stay depressed. It's hard to let go. It's hard to not stay in my depression if I don't keep my body this way. Like I have to kind of, and you sometimes notice that you're walking and you're just like brooding about something. And if you could just open your eyes and take in your surroundings, take in the beauty of nature, the movement of a bird, that starts to broaden that, helps to loosen that grip. And then you can do, you know, more directly around like asking a question or bringing forth a quality. Like Rodney Smith, the founder of Seattle Insight, would sometimes talk about this vertical question, kind of calling forth that question right here, right now. Like a question is like, where is there love in this moment? Where is there silence? Where is there happiness in this moment? And what that does is it shifts, he called it a vertical question because usually when our mind's caught in something, we're in kind of this horizontal realm, this time-based realm, past and future, where the vertical brings us right into this present moment. So it's a way of shifting into that present moment, calling it forth. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's, I think that would be a lovely, you know, dialogue for people to talk about. How do you shift into happiness? How do you bring that forth? Things like gratitude, appreciation can also be really powerful ways to bring that. You know, what am I grateful in my life? What am I really truly feel, let myself feel that. Thank you. All right, go ahead, Lori.
With the different sutta references and your teachings over time and tonight, I'm really getting a sense of also you're inviting through the Buddha's teachings that there's a happiness in this right understanding, this ability to tolerate the things that are distressing, because it's almost letting them burn out, like, oh yeah, I might want to do this, but just tolerating distress and that being happiness, you know, this right understanding, just like when you were talking about you and your wife at, I don't know where it was, up in the wilderness, and changing your debt load. So you could tolerate the desire to want, but that habit energy's there, but yet that too brought you happiness to not, to tolerate that old energy, because you had confidence in this new way. So anyway, just more teachings on how to tolerate that discomfort, knowing that it's wholesome. I don't know. Anyway, thank you, Tim.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. Yeah, I think that's a good way of framing it, is that we often need to have some kind of framework or something we can trust to be able to try to do the hard work of tolerating or working with the difficult. Yeah, and like that example, okay, I think being in debt's not so good. Let's have this commitment to be out of debt. So that's kind of a very householder kind of process. But the Dharma also has all these very beautiful ways of leading us forth. Like I remember on retreat once at Cloud Mountain, feeling hearing the sound of the mosquitoes and feeling the deep visceral, you know, angst around that, just in my skin around it, and wanting to, you know, slap them away, and deciding not to do that, to follow the precept of non-harm, to practice with the difficulty. And so what was framing that is like, okay, my sense of resistance to this experience is causing my suffering. You know, that fighting experience amplifies how much suffering I was having. So there's an interest of trying to work with that, to find a way through that. And I remember during the retreat, the mosquitoes would follow me around, and, you know, I was doing walking meditation, and there'd be like this cloud, and feeling the high, hearing the high-pitched whine, and feeling the very visceral reaction to them, but not to move with it, to just, okay, I'm going to open to the sensations of it, I'm going to try to be as spacious as I can. It was super intense. But after 7 days, and luckily they didn't tend to bite till the evening, they just kind of followed me around, and I turned and they would be like, oh, he's going this other way. And, you know, and so it was kind of this slow game of chase. But it was amazing, at the end of the retreat, I could hear the mosquito without the association, that reaction. It would just sound, right? And that's a process of you talked about burning through it, is meeting it. And that's part of the forms of this tradition, is like we ask you to sit still as best you can, to sit within this experience. And those of you who have been practicing for a while have many examples like that. I sat with something. Sometimes it's a physical pain. You think, okay, that back is just hurting and I need to just change it, but I'm going to sit with it. I'm going to open to it. And sometimes something shifts and it just dissolves. Other times you need to, you know, lay down and take care of yourself. That's where that discernment comes in, is when do I learn to take care of myself? When's a more practical approach needed versus more of this meeting this in a meditative way? by having that bigger framework. Okay, this is about learning. One of my favorite ways to learn it, to look at it, is physical discomfort, emotional discomfort. These are all kind of templates that we can practice in often a controlled way, a kind of a low stakes way. I know some of us have a lot of physical pain, a lot of difficulties, and to not negate that, those kind of need different strategies. But if it's kind of a moderate amount, I can practice the skill of meeting it, or relaxing with it. That teaches me how to be with bigger pain, bigger loss. You know, learning to not follow an itch helps me not be reactive in my emails, for example. Not through denying, not through repressing, but really, as you said, through understanding, through wisdom. Thank you, Lori.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have a question, but I did have a response to the earlier comment about what you can do to make yourself more happy. So I'm English, and we don't like being happy. We're very fond of our misery, and we don't like people interfering with it very much. Now, this is my first time in America, but in England, I had a job selling Kirby vacuum cleaners, and all our bosses were American. So this is where I get my impression of what you people are like. And then as we'd have these sales meetings in the daytime, we'd have to go out and sell at night these very expensive vacuum cleaners. And the American boss was all very chipper and bright, and you had to be happy and you had to be enthusiastic, and by God, it was annoying. So every time that we'd see some of the Americans coming along, we'd all like nudge each other and we'd go, "Oh boy, do I feel good. Oh boy, do I feel good. Oh boy, do I feel good." Until he'd come in, and then he'd leave, and then oh God. So then one day he came along and I just wasn't feeling good. And I said, "Oh boy, do I feel good." I said, "You know what? I don't feel good." And he looked at me with this compassion and he took out $20. It's pounds, but I'll change it for you. Took out $20 and he stuffed it in my pocket. He said, "How do you feel now?" I said, "I'm still having a bad day." He took out another $20. He stuffed it in another pocket. He said, "How do you feel now?" I said, "Well, things are looking up." He took out another $20 and he stuffed it in my pocket. He said, "Now how do you feel?" I said, "Oh boy, do I feel good." And then he took all the money back and said, "Now go and sell something." So that's what I think Americans are like. If you want. Anyway, I'm Pandit. I've been a monk 30 years. I live in Bangkok. So if any of you ever come to Bangkok, maybe I'll see you there.
Okay. Thank you, Bandi. That is a funny story. Yes, Suze, go ahead.
So some of us just finished the 5-week series on the Anapanasati Sutta, the practice of the breath, and there's 16 steps, and the last 4 of them are around the wisdom teachings of impermanence and cessation and relinquishment and that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I don't understand cessation. I don't know what that is. But through this series, I realized, and I think cessation is then connected to happiness, that when difficult things arise in my business or in my life, if I just acknowledge, "Oh, this is difficult," but don't make it into a thing, make it into something that's like more than what it is. Just let it be whatever that is. And when I watch the mind trying to make it into something more, when I stopped doing that, I felt an opening to what is meant by cessation. And right next to it was kind of a sense of happiness. Mm. it was just an easefulness, I think. Like, I wasn't making something bigger than it was. And it was pretty, I don't do it all the time, but when I've had that experience, I can really feel the lack of the tension that I had created by making so much of a thing out of some tenant issue or some business thing or whatever. You know, just like, oh yeah, this is a thing and I've got to deal with it. And that's all it is. As opposed to something, you know, so that kind of the not doing that feels way more contented and happy.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's, I love those moments of seeing kind of the possibility of acting differently, or just find myself acting differently. And I can reflect on the past. Well, I would have acted in a very maybe reactive way, or in a way that was self-destructive or lashing out. And there's a lot of joy that comes from that. There's a happiness that comes from that. There's a lightness. And, you know, perhaps some of that lightness is that we're freeing up some of those deep roots of greed and hatred and delusion. We're seeing more clearly. And our actions, because we can have, you know, we can have lots of insights and lots of understanding, but until it translates into action, it's still kind of unproved, if you will. When we actually act from that, when we know that, okay, this is actually showing my life is changing because I've changed. The way I'm perceiving the world has changed, and the actions open up, and there's a tremendous happiness and joy that comes from that. Yeah, thank you, Sus.
So today I had an experience of, you know, as I think about causes and conditions and how my life came to be where I am now and the experiences, and most of those causes and conditions I had no control over. They just were what they were, and some things now are what they are. But the joy of the practice is I have rooted out a lot of those things, the causes and conditions, and what my mind does with them. And today I was sitting in meditation and watching the thoughts go by, and was very aware that I went, okay, I like that one. And it's not a good thought. You know, it's something, oh, I'm a terrible person. And it's like, okay, I reached up and took that. So I could let it go. And with this stream of things, as I practice goodness, you know, what have I done well today? What do I have to be thankful for? Just to kind of switch that off. But the habit of my mind to go to the negative is so strong that it's surprising. But those moments, which are a lot more than they ever were, of real happiness and going, oh yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on that really, you know, money, this, that, whatever, and to go, oh yeah, well, this is all going to pass, and nothing is ever perfect, so even if everything were perfect, I would probably still want to find something. That's my aversive mind. So I'm very grateful to have some moments of happiness as a result of this practice.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there's, and the sense of being able to see that pattern, to see that tendency you want to take a hold. And I mean, think about, you know, how many years back that you didn't even see that. You're just too busy just grabbing it and inhabiting it and living it, you know, and all the destructive ways that it came up. But the fact that you see it, even the fact that you still did it, that seeing it starts to change, that becomes the positive end of karma, of action. You're doing a sankara that's actually starting to unhook these deeper roots.
Well, and also realizing that before it was all just sitting with me, and that was who I am.
That's right.
And to have it be out there and go, oh, I can choose something different.
Yes.
And that freedom, and that is real freedom, is pretty amazing. And it's the things that early on in the practice, I didn't know what that was. So keep at it.
Yes, and you can hear the happiness, hear the joy of that. Yeah, beautiful. All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a very rich evening, and I want to go over one more thing that you've covered beautifully, you and the speakers. But I was trying to sit tonight, and I have a few things in my life that I don't like, and they would come up, and then I would, I don't know exactly what would happen, but I would just maybe focus on my body or go back to my breath or something, and have a few quiet moments, and then up it would come again, this annoying thing, this, you know, anxious thing we're struggling with. And it seemed to me as though the mind, I'm trying to figure out where it's coming from, and it seems to me the mind was whipping it up. And I wondered if, I think you've mentioned some strategies, but again, just to maybe fine point it here a little bit, what you would do in a moment like that.
So tell me more about how the mind's whipping it up. How do you know that? How do you experience that?
Well, because I remember it when I'm already quiet. Here it comes again.
So you see it's trying to arise out of the quiet?
Yeah.
Now, when you see it arising, do you have a different kind of a little bit more perspective than before when you're just lost in it, or sometimes you just get lost in it?
No, I'm mad. Or, you know, yeah. Maybe annoyed or with perspective, yeah, I suppose. Maybe some this again, and I know what to do with these things. Or, you know, at least go back to my body again, go back to breathing. But you've mentioned so many things here tonight that are more uplifting than that. I hope I can hang on to those.
Well, you keep it simple, because, you know, these things, these kind of patterns that arise have a lot of momentum. They really kind of, it's almost like we're getting on a roller coaster, and we're strapped in, and before we know it, we're doing all these gyrations all over the place. It's like as soon as you notice it, try to interject a little bit of compassion and wisdom into that. Just compassion is probably a good one to put with something that's painful. It's like, oh, okay, just kind of almost even touch your heart. You can physically touch your heart and say, oh, okay, you know, I'm feeling that. Because in that moment of seeing, it's sometimes very fleeting, but in that moment of seeing, I mean, it's like if you look at dependent origination, that moment of seeing, that's the launching pad, that moment of contact launches us into these patterns. But if we interject a little bit of compassion, a little bit of wisdom, of clarity in that moment of seeing, then the whole thing can start to become less less solid, less reinforcing.
Yeah, very, very helpful and sensible. Thank you.
You're welcome. And after you've had that moment of seeing and that compassion, then just see if there's a choices that start to open, like Christy's talking about. There's different choices. You have that choice of how we act. You know, mindfulness, Christina Feldman talked about mindfulness in some ways slows down our pattern of reactivity, so we have that potential to choose in a way that's more skillful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, go ahead, Ryan.
Tim, you talked about a number of sort of sources of happiness, some of which, you know, the Buddha's own suttas. And it struck me that a number of those sources of happiness are sort of fundamentally transient. We experience them, or it could be, you know, the joy of seeing the sunrise. There's all sorts of passing moment ways to experience happiness. But it's interesting because it feels like culturally, much more broadly, we sort of talk about happiness as something that's not transient but an end state. Are you happy? As if the experience of that is supposed to be something that you sort of get to as a lasting outcome in the end.
That's right.
I'm a happy person. The search for happiness. So it's interesting because it feels like we're setting up this dichotomy that is destined for suffering. My search is for happiness as an end state, when happiness is never going to be an end state. It's always going to be transient. And so I'm wondering if you could just expand on that a little bit, or,
sure,
or think about how should we be thinking about those, and you know, and what sources of happiness, or if that's even a reasonable expectation.
Well, one way that comes to mind is just, you know, the story of the Buddha, and his, you know, before he became the Buddha, he was he really had it made, right? He had so much pleasure, all the stuff that is unpleasant was really shielded from him. But he had glimpses into that through those heavenly messengers of age, of sickness, of death, and also of the path of the Brahman who inspired him to find that way. So I think the question he was really holding, and that's really the question we hold today, is where is there that ease and happiness in the midst of all of this change, the fact that everything's changing? And so it's this line of enjoying things as they're arising, but realizing that they will change, they will go away. But one way to approach it is, what doesn't change? What's outside of change? We talk about impermanence. All things that are conditioned are permanent, right? But if something is unconditioned, you know, unconditioned is one way of talking about awareness, or that their liberated mind, that quality of deep awakening. You know, then there's this quality of things can come and go, and still there's this thing that which is unchanging. And we kind of tap into that as meditators, actually what we're trying to incline ourselves to do as mindfulness practitioners, is to observe the nature of change. That thing that is observing is unchanging, right? And then kind of a deeper level, that is the identity behind that observation. When that starts to be seen as also changing, you know, what's seeing all that is unchanging, right? And so then the voices that say, okay, your happiness is this endpoint. Once you get there, you get to retirement, you get to summer break, you know, your kids leave school, your kids come back from school, you know, you get married, you get divorced, whatever it is, all those things, those endpoints, that's going to make us happy. We start to hold that with a lot more clarity. We realize that it's a temporary happiness that's arising and passing away. And we start to find that happiness that is more lasting, that is, has that quality of substantiality, is outside of the conditions of our life. So that's what I would frame it. You know, use the meditation technique, what that's teaching, and take that in a deeper way around the life of, you know, of ups and downs. Does that get to your question, Ryan?
Yeah, very much. That's great. Thank you.
Okay, you bet. All right. Maybe one more if there's anyone. Okay, go ahead. We could do Alex and the other hand, which I can't see right now. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, thank you. I was starting to think about kind of the in-between space from happiness and suffering.
Yes.
And my mind started to go towards kind of someone experiencing almost like depression or low mood or a flatness, where maybe the old story of suffering has disappeared, but there's still this almost like something else that is pulling down the opportunity of happiness to arrive. And I'm curious about that subtlety, and if there is subtlety there, or if it is kind of just two buckets. It's happiness and then dukkha.
So happiness around like those kind of almost biochemical things of depression, is that what you're kind of pointing toward? Or just kind of the happiness or the sense of depression or sadness that kind of keeps everything down?
Yeah, I'm curious about how that maybe translates to, yeah, more the mental health side of how we think about things.
Yeah. Yeah, the mental health side, you know, there is also the caring for our kind of our brain chemistry, right? Sometimes we do need to have interventions around that. We need it, whether it's pharmaceuticals or different ways that we eat or having working with seasonal affective disorder, all those kind of things can be very helpful. Because we can't, that's what I'm trying to say is that we, as practitioners, sometimes we look at the Dharma as, okay, this is going to fix everything. But sometimes we need to have a more practical fix or use all the tools available. That being said, sometimes that depression is a kind of a stance that we kind of have learned or developed or adaptive or whatever, for whatever reason. We can start to get a sense of that itself, kind of stepping back to see it as an experience in itself. It's tricky because some of those states, like depression, it tends to, we look at it, and before we know it, we're actually seeing from the depression. The depression is actually changing the very way we're perceiving life, perceiving experience. So being able to step back enough to kind of get our heads above water, and that's some of those, maybe more robust interventions, going for a walk or being with loved ones or something that kind of shifts us so we can have enough perspective. Because anything that's really prolonged, chronic pain, for example, chronic pain or chronic depression, those really take on a whole life of their own. It can be a lot to try to see through, and yet, as practitioners, there's people who've been able to really see through those. And we often do need some other interventions to help with that.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you. So, Anastasia, I think I saw your hand up too.
Yeah, I'll try to be really quick. Thank you, Tim.
Sure.
I don't know if I'm saying anything new, but one of the things that I'm finding really overwhelming and difficult to maybe prioritize how I approach discernment is when I am vicariously feeling pain, I'm witnessing suffering of so many people.
Yeah.
And I feel like I need to do something about it. And that causes its own suffering in me. I just wanted to bring it up, I guess. I just appreciate being able to say that to people who understand.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes we can actually do something about it, and sometimes we're helpless in the face of it. Is that part of the territory too? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's kind of this very personal way that we learn to navigate, suffering. And suffering in ourselves, suffering in others, is how do we find a way of relating that allows us to still stay capable, still stay whole, and not to be overwhelmed by it. And sometimes we're in circumstances, professions, or our loved ones, the suffering that we see every day, it just starts to really overwhelm us, overwhelm our system. And so sometimes it's finding, how do we have the right level of caring, but also kind of integrity at the same time. We could talk about, Kuan Yin opening to the 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 joys of the world. And, how do we do that as part of is expanding the heart, the container of it, bringing emptiness along with it, or I should say wisdom, to see the impersonal or universal nature as well as the personal. Those are all ways to practice with it. And sometimes it's really more about kind of sheltering ourselves and saying that if I open to, sometimes we're just more naturally sensitive and we feel pain very acutely in others and we become overwhelmed by it. So sometimes it's learning how to be a little bit, kind of having our shields up a little bit so we're not completely open, especially if we're in a caring profession. How do we still be functional and connected and have offering of service without at our own expense? And it's an interesting line to play with.
Yeah, it is. Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate being able to talk about it. Actually, you nailed it too. I'm in a profession where I am a steward of other people's trauma in a way. Yeah, and then just piling on top of, just just hearing about the earthquake and Palestine and, you know, Lebanon and, you know, just like there's endless suffering in the world, it feels like. So, yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. It's learning how to open and close those valves without closing them, you know, too much. But yeah,
that's right. And to realize that, you know, the news outlets and all those sources, they don't necessarily have your mental and emotional health at their forefront, right? It's like, hey, look at this horrible thing. Oh, you like that horrible thing? Here's another one. Oh, here's an even worse one. And it's,
yeah,
you know, sometimes what I do when I'm listening to the radio and I hear about some tragedy, I like to turn the radio off and just be with that one tragedy. Because it's like, if I can open to that one suffering in a full, complete way, in a balanced way, then that's more helpful than opening to 10 or 1,000 that I get overwhelmed by.
Yeah, I feel guilt too.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But.
Yeah. And that's part of the process of notice where those something like guilt, when that arises, that's going to have this whole kind of way that we feel like we have to feel. If we don't worry and care, then we're not loving.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this could be, I could talk about this for another hour.
Yeah. I think that would be a good topic to unpack for many people. Yeah.
Thank you
for sharing that.
Thanks.
All right. We got one more quick one. If you have to leave, go ahead, but let's honor that.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to, I'm Jeremy here, they. I wanted to respond to some of that with something that's helped me a lot in the past few years over some of the same issues that Anastasia mentioned. But I think a very important step both to not let that, like the sadness of what's happening turn into like dukkha, and actually be able to process process tragedy without it turning into something that's sort of like hidden inside and turning into something that I think is more suffering. I think is like being able to appreciate and have gratitude for your own empathy. I think there's this sense in our culture that like pain is bad, but in many ways, it's very good to feel that pain, especially on behalf of others. And that's something that I think we should not take pride in, because that's a like, oh, look at me, I'm so cool, I care about injustice or whatever. But more just that it's very beautiful and important for us to have that empathy and therefore to have that pain, because we also live in a world where a lot of people don't have that empathy. And I think when we have gratitude for that, that can allow us to appreciate the energy that like suffering creates in us. And then I think we can more productively channel that pain into action without it turning into dukkha. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you for sharing that, Jeremy. That's I have to think about that. I think that's a lovely, lovely way of appreciation for our own empathy. And that brings that a different quality other than overwhelm, and that brings energy into action. Yeah, well said. All right, thank you all, and enjoy the rest of your evening. Thank you online.